Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances. We're talking about working money makes you feel like you're in Wakanda.
Boom. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. If you're wondering what that awkward pause was, I was trying to make some commentary, then realized I haven't watched the movie yet. So follow our...
What is you doing?
Actually, Bay wasn't available, and I got one of those suggestive texts. It's like, yeah, you're not going to see the movie until I get there, right? Question mark. Let me delete this in-app purchase, but so I will be seeing it soon. Follow our individual accounts and my adventures and updates at the Marcus Garrett, 2 T's everywhere on Earth, 1 T on Twitter, and Rich is available at I Am Rich Jones.
I am. And today's episode is also sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/paychecks to support the show and see if you qualify. Don't get caught slipping into the afterlife. So what's going on, man?
I feel like this Health IQ is a weekly reminder that I need to set up some preventative things. So I did make it to the annual physical, but I got to get my eyes checked and I need to get my, I guess, your teeth checked. I need to find a local dentist. But it's just one of those things that I haven't made a priority, and I got the health covered for it. So I really have no excuse whatsoever. I just read things at like 150%. I just overcompensate.
Yo, you've been back home for some time, man. You ain't got a local dentist yet?
Damn, you just put me on front street like that. But actually, no, I do not, good sir. Appreciate that. And here's what the thing was. It took me forever, through no doing but my own, to find one in Denver that I liked. And I'm going to try to say something without being inappropriate. So bear with me here, folks. That's why I open with that disclaimer. I like to go to women dentists, because in my experience, I find that like whenever I have a male dentist, like they don't have the same pain tolerance sympathy that I feel like. They'd be like, oh, you're flinching a little bit. I'm like, yo, you have a metal tool on my gum right now and it's already uncomfortable. So I have found that like men, like they try to like, yo, man up, you know what I'm saying? Like, yo, yeah, I know I'm digging in your mouth with this metal instrument. But and I'm like, I feel like you should be making the adjustments. Yeah. So, I don't know. That's just my personal experience, my personal preference. I like to have a woman dentist and I usually have male doctors. So, you know, for whatever it's worth, I felt that I should share that insight. And I'm lazy. I got to look online and find the local dentist and do all that, make sure they have the coverage. It's crazy. You know, it's a personal finance show, but I have actively been procrastinating because every time I start to do it, I just get a headache.
So I'm not going to front. Because I'm bad on the doctor front, and I feel like with 35 coming up, it's at that point where I really should be getting a physical every year, and I don't. And last time I went to a doctor, they were like, do you have a primary care physician? I was like, nah. And they were like, when's the last time you had a physical? I was like, I don't know. So this probably is a fitting time for that. So I'm there with you, but in a different way. I have been to the doctor, though, but only because like I was coughing. And I'm one of those people who every time something happens, I want to go to the doctor. It's like, my back hurts. Do I have kidney stones? My knee hurts. Like, is there a blood clot in the front of my knee, a place where you never get it? I go on WebMD, and that's what gets me there. But I haven't had anything like that in a while. But I do need to get my primary care physician game up.
That's interesting because I usually have to designate a primary care physician whenever I transfer. So like you said, I just moved recently, so maybe that's why you haven't. On the dental front, I got no excuse. I'm just lazy. Now, I will say every time I go, I usually get like a good report. You know what I'm saying? I'm flossing. I do all the things you need to do except go to the dentist part. Because I don't like it.
I get it, man. I get it. So I know people are probably like, yo, where's the work and money talk? Y'all talking about dentists and other mundane things. Who are we talking to today?
It had to do with healthcare. Today we're chatting with the early retirement dude. We are going to cover his tips, tricks, and epiphany he had to retire at the internet old but young life, I guess, age of 36. Listen, learn, prosper.
And he's not Wakandan, but that's okay. Hope you enjoy.
Today, we're joined by early retirement dude, who I will refer to as the dude. I'm not going to say why. For those of you who are old enough, you should know. For those of you who are young enough to know, Google it. I first found out about him after reading a very detailed article called The History of FIRE on Rockstar Finance. He retired 12 years ago when he was only 36 after a 13-year career. He's 48 now, or at least he was as of the time that I read that bio, and has come to share his wisdom with us mere mortals on the topic covering fire. For those of you new to the show, this is Financial Independence Retire Early, an area that we are growing in interest. He will also share his philosophy, finance, and what he does all day. We're happy to have him on the show to share his message with us and teach us the ways of the early retirement gurus. Welcome to Paychecks and Balances.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I'm happy to be here. Wisdom, I don't know about that. Now, I can certainly share some ignorance with you so you can head in the opposite direction if you want. But yeah, thank you for that.
Interestingly enough, I feel like most of my wisdom comes from all the ignorance. And the hardest part that I've tried to overcome is teaching young people to do it sooner. The most difficult is like, how do I get, if I was talking to the younger version of myself, if I went back in time and told myself, hey, man, if you just do this, I'm just as equally likely to like slap me out of the way as I am to listen to my own advice. So I think that wisdom does come from that experience. And I read recently, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, one of the books that I'm working through, that you should make all your mistakes by age 30, because at least maybe you'll have time to recover. So I seem to be on the right path.
I seem to be behind schedule, according to what you just said, but that's okay.
I'm still making mistakes. Don't get me wrong. I'm not done. So the dude, is there any other background information the audience should know about you?
I can certainly roll out my life story if you like. I'll tell you quickly how I got on the early retirement track, if you think that'd be a good thing to share with your listeners. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was working in commercial radio when I was in MBA school, in college radio. Loved music, loved that whole lifestyle. It was like party all night and work all day. It was a perfect fit for my personality. But being in MBA school, I had bought into the line of reasoning that you've got to get a quote good job, you know, which in this case meant corporate and specifically marketing and finance. So after I graduated, I hung up all the radio work and, you know, went to put on a suit and went to work in a cubicle and stuff. And I was just immediately miserable. So having learned a lot about finance in grad school, I started trying to recapture a sense of control over my own life by taking good care of my finances. And I realized, you know, compound interest and concepts like that, that are really simple, would in fact be able to propel me out of corporate America if I stuck to a plan long enough. So I put that plan together and it worked.
And I'm hoping this is a quick question. Do you still see the value or the same value in graduate school? Do you look back and reflect on that MBA and, you know, I'm glad I got it? Do you think the cost have devalued the return that people are seeing on graduate school?
I will say that I think you can obtain a level of education that's equal to that by being self-taught. You can read the same books. You can watch online classes. And even though you won't get, you know, quote, resume credit, unquote, for all of that, you'll still save yourself a lot of money and have the same amount of knowledge. So do I think it's worth it to go to grad school? I think it depends on the individual situation, honestly.
So I also have to ask.
Yeah.
How did you have that forethought? So you retired at age 36, but even within that time frame, how in your 20s, was there something different about you? Or is it something that you learned to say, I'm already going to get on the path of early retirement?
Yeah, I got to get out of here. It all comes down to one moment that crystallized that thought process in my head. I had just gone to work in this job, getting up too early, being treated as the kid. It was a middle-aged office, and I was the youngest one there. I mean, there were all kinds of reasons that went into this. So I'm walking past a window one day. It's the middle of the summer, and I'm looking out into this beautiful sunlight, and I know that so many of my friends are out there running around and drinking beer and kayaking and having all this fun. And there I am going to, you know, some meeting that I know nothing about and keeping my mouth shut. And I've got to go through 7 more hours of that, you know. So that got me on the track pretty quick. I went back to my cubicle and started modeling my escape that day, that same day.
So you pretty much had the thing where you gazed off into the distance, the sunlight hit your face, and you were like, I can't live this life anymore.
I guess it's a pretty good metaphor. Yeah.
So. It's interesting. I actually appreciate you saying that, because there's a grandiose metaphor in that simplicity, because I often have these discussions with people. I'm like, I'm looking to retire early. I don't think I'll cover it in the next 365 days. So I'm not going to hit the 36 scale like you.
But people talk to you like you're crazy. And so I'll have these conversations. They'll be like, man, I've got ulcers. I'm stressed out at work. I take it home. The wife is upset with me because I'm always working. I don't get to see my dog and my kids. And I'm like, yeah, man, I want to get out of here as soon as possible. And they're like, quit work. I'm like, you just described all these negative things and effects that it's having on your life. The one consistent factor is the 40 hours that is allocated to work, and yet they can't wrap their head around removing that as soon as possible, cutting it out. And that's equally strange to me. So we both give each other like this weird, like the Spider-Man meme where we both point at each other and then walk off frustrated. Like, that's equally as strange to me that they can't wrap their head around there's another lifestyle out there and I should be trying to get there as quickly as possible. Did you run into that as well?
Oh, my in-laws thought I was out of my mind. My fiance and I hadn't gotten married yet when they came out to visit and kind of scoped me out. They lived out west. And, you know, inevitably you're talking to your father-in-law and he's like, what do you want to do with your life, son? So, you know, I told him about this plan, and they had grown up, both of them had grown up kind of poor, relatively speaking. And they were baby boomers. And the idea, I think, and I'm being an amateur shrink here, but I think the idea of turning your back on a good job and walking away was foreign to them. And I think that especially in the context of the guy who was going to marry their daughter and drag her down this path too, you know, was kind of alien. Yes. So they thought I was nuts. They thought I was nuts. They resisted the idea for sure. So it does happen. Now that I've been doing this for so long, it doesn't come up much. People see that I've got a track record. But at first, especially after I split, I learned the hard way to quit talking about it.
So talking about it to like friends, family, or everyone?
For the most part, people don't get it. And so they switch you off and change the topic of conversation. Very, very seldom do people ask the question, well, how do I get on that track? How do I do this? And yeah, I finally figured out that maybe my friends thought I was just bragging to them about my lifestyle and having, you know, some money and stuff like that. So I thought, well, let's just cut that off. Let's just not even go there. And if they hear about it or if they figure out about it and they want to ask, then that's cool.
Yeah, I read something recently along those lines. They said most billionaires, what they have in common is that most people don't ask them how they made the money, but they do ask them for jobs and loans. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that that mindset is fascinating as well. But I do have to ask, to be fair, because I'm trying to wrap my head around it. What do you do retired at 36? What does that lifestyle look like?
Don't let anybody kid you. And I'll lead with something a little negative so I can then transition to the positives. But it does get a little boring sometimes. I mean, I have a daughter. She's wonderful. She's 13 years old. I see her off to school in the morning. She's gone for 7 hours, and then we pick her up in the afternoon, and then, you know, fun time begins. But we, yeah, there's 7 hours there where I've got to try to keep my life structured and accomplish some productive things. And sometimes the to-do list all gets done, and I'm hanging out at the house, or I go for a run, and I'm done running, and I'm like, well, now what? You know, now what? You know, that said, there is so much room. There is so much room for investigating and carrying out things that you are interested in. I'm the kind of person who likes to stick his head in whatever interests him. I don't necessarily have one big passion. So, you know, if your listeners may have a variety of interests, maybe they get to investigate those. Maybe they have that one all-consuming passion. They're certainly going to have the opportunity to get much better at it. You can stay in shape. You can do your grocery shopping during the day when nobody else is there. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, there's just so many things that you can get up to. You don't just have to sit around on the couch.
I was laughing because that sounds like an introvert's paradise. And it reminds me, my folks are retired now. They're in their 60s, so they take more of a traditional route. And they told me the only way they lose track of the days, which, you know, is a luxury to have. And the only way they know when school is in or out is they'll be out during the day and it's more crowded. They're like, why are all these people out here crowding up the roads? I'm like, it's summer break. They're like, oh, like, yeah, that's their only frame of reference to what's going on in the world around them. These are the kind of illusions that I want to have where I just forget what days and months are happening.
Let me add one more thing. I mean, this is, again, to your listeners who are interested in this lifestyle. I like to say people who don't have a strong vision for retirement won't retire. you hear people say, I can't imagine what I would do all day if I wasn't working. Well, that's why you're not going to quit work. Hmm. Yeah.
And so when you say strong vision, what do you mean by that? You know, is that something that people are emotionally connected to or just something that's very clear? Because those could be two different things.
You need to know what you'd rather be doing. You need to know, I'd rather spend more time with my kids. I'd rather write that novel I've already been always been wanting to write. I want to be doing volunteer work. I want to be traveling. And it even helps to start making specific plans, you know, for those activities, indulging yourself in a little bit of escapism. So you really need to know what you'd rather be doing. I'm miserable. I need to take off so I can spend more time on the beach, whatever. You really need to know what you'd rather be doing. Otherwise, you know, people say, what would I do with myself? I wouldn't know what to do with myself. And that's frightening.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that's a good point. And we actually had a listener specifically write in about this. But have there been any people that you've talked to and they start to describe either what they're going through at work or what they would think they would go through in retirement? And ultimately, your answer is you should stay at the day job. Like, don't quit your day job. Is there any people that you encourage to stay working the 9-to-5?
Anybody who loves their job.
That's not many people that I know, but.
Right. I think there are people who love their jobs out there. I think there are people for whom the daily drag, you know, the 9-to-5 or what have you, the 8-to-8 or what have you, makes what goes on in their own, you know, personal time worthwhile. You know, so I'm some guy, I don't necessarily like my job or my commute, but my kids are the joy of my world. And by doing this, I can send them to good schools. I can, you know, make sure there's food on the table. I can be a good dad. I can do all this stuff. And if I get a lot of satisfaction from that, then it makes the sacrifices worthwhile. So people like that should stay in the 9-to-5, I think.
And Rich, I'm going to somewhat disagree, although I think we're saying the same thing. This came up during our previous discussion on the Financial Samurai episode. I'll get that in the show notes. But it was, I think people enjoy their job in the beginning.
Well,
and I think that's fairly universal.
Yeah.
Because I think that when you're first wrapping your head around, because I remember when I made the transition from college, and I was 22 and I got my first job. I was like, I've made it. I'm adulting. I didn't even know what adulting was at the time. I don't even think the word existed. So, but I really felt like I had accomplished something great. And then I burned out like 2 years later. I think in the beginning, I was like, this is awesome. And we talked about before, I still enjoy aspects of my job. I was actually doing some math on this earlier. And I think what it is my job's a slightly less flexible than some in that I don't have the kind of work from home opportunities that some people that I know have.
Is that shade? Are you throwing shade at me for my ability to telecommute?
I mean, I feel like you might have some personal way that you feel about this, but actually I was not. I was speaking in generalities, good sir. But that's exactly my point. And so what I realize is it might not be the job or any job, and I say this that I dislike, it's work because of the way that it's structured. And then you talk to that a little bit, the dude, is that you show up, you go to this cubicle, you go to these meetings. Geico has this hilarious commercial out right now with the teleconference that I think I relived 7 times that week, where they call in and someone else calls in. Hello? Oh, I had you on mute. Oh, well, you talk. No, you talk. No, you. And it's like, it's insane to me that this is a reality that multiple people would buy into. And we're just all sitting around like, yeah, this is what you do. And not only this is what you do it for this defined box of 40 hours a week, 5 days every week for, you know, at least 280 days. And that assumes that you get a decent amount of paid time off. So for folks who want to transition, what would you say is the priority? Because a lot of us are facing debt now, you know, $16,000 on average for credit card debt, $37,000 in school loan debt. That's why I asked that question. Which one do you think they should tackle first? Is it the debt, the retirement savings, or all of the above?
Don't they walk hand in hand? I mean, it's tough to, how do you save money? How do you load up your, you know, 401k in hopes of that 7.5%, you know, average return when you're paying 18% on a credit card? Right. You've got to knock that stuff down before you can really sensibly start saving. But at the same time, getting out of the workforce is about a lot more than just saving money. You need to be acquiring the skills to DIY stuff, to like do minor car repairs and figure out how to repair your dishwasher when it dies. Those kinds of things you don't have to spend money on. There's YouTube. You can do anytime you want, even during slow times at work. And I think in the long run, that kind of stuff, those kinds of optimizations are going to be just as conducive to your ability to get out of the workforce.
So, yeah, I like that. I like that. Mm-hmm.
And so you have this piece that's called the Early Retirement Magic Bullet. I was taking a look at that before we jumped on the podcast, and it covers things that, for people who aren't familiar, which is probably a good chunk of the audience, it covers some of the things to keep in mind if you are trying to pursue this lifestyle. And so you say, first and foremost, learn. And then you go into this other bucket of having something, and it has active strategies. One, living below your means, and then use the principle of avoided costs. Now, we've talked a lot on the podcast about this idea of living below your means. And Marcus, there's something you say, like, I feel like every other episode that's like super simple, and I should probably know the quote by now. That's my bad, good brother. But this idea of avoided costs, can you talk a little bit about that?
I think the example I use in that article under avoided cost is something like daycare, I believe. You know, you yeah. get the one parent who is essentially working to pay for the daycare. Well, what is that worth? I mean, you know, you're going to have a stay-at-home parent. People are going to say, well, you're a one-income family. You know, it's not a stretch to say, no, I'm actually a two-income family. Here's the cost we avoided. What's the difference between going into work or staying at home and taking care of my kid? Nothing. I might as well stay at home and take care of my kid. So there's an avoided cost of daycare, whatever that happens to be, however many $100 a month that happens to be. But there's also, and this is my opinion, but you know, in my opinion, you're giving your kid a better childhood, giving them a better boost through life by doing that. So what is that worth? What's that worth to your family? I would also argue quite a bit. Mm.
That's an excellent point. And we'll get that in the show notes. We have a Kids Cost What episode. I don't have those numbers memorized. But someone on Twitter was recently talking about how much she couldn't drop down to part-time work. Well, she basically had to choose between working full-time or not working at all, because the irony was, if she worked part-time, she would actually lose money on just childcare. So she would make more money by staying home and having those hours to herself to work and do things, like you said, DIY, do it yourself, versus going to a full-time job. And I think that amounts around like $18,000 on average. You know, it's different around the country. So basically, you have to at least make $18,000 after taxes just to justify going to work, just to pay for childcare, if you had that one income that you're talking about. So you net that $18,000. And then what people don't think about, which I think is funny, is it's actually interesting how disconnected people are from money, and they're always talking about money. But there's the transportation. There's the vehicle that you have to maintain. I saw something ridiculous, like to maintain a vehicle for a year is like in the multiple thousands. So you know, most people just think, oh, I got to make this car payment. No, you got to make the car payment. You got to maintain it. You got to get the oil changes. You got to put the new tires on it. You got to put gas in it every week or month, depending on your travel. You're sitting in traffic for, I think they say the average commute to work back and forth is like 2.5 hours. And most people are just like, well, I just make a car payment, a monthly car payment. And I'm like, no, there's all those hours you lost traveling to and from work. So most people are like, well, I work 40 hours. I'm like, no, you drive to work, I think. Or even if you take transportation to work, those are hours in your day that I also would say hours avoided. And people just, they don't think about that because they only think about, well, what's the one expense I pay on this without all the multiple expenses that go into it, including, I would say, an hours is an expense, which is why it's important to know how much your time costs.
Mm-hmm. You can extend that to working to your own benefit in terms of, say, your physical health, taking care of yourself. I hear so many people say, I don't have time to exercise. All right, well, I mean, you're, you know, pretty good odds there that you're cutting down on your lifespan. If you're not keeping yourself in shape. And so it's, you have all these little stress habits, you know, so you're eating and you're just doing various things that sandbag yourself. So there's another, you can't put a dollar amount on that, but you're certainly going to have a higher quality of life if you take care of your body and your mind. So,
yeah. So are there things that come to mind in terms of avoidable costs that people tend to overlook? So for example, going to the gym and being healthy could be one of those because it shortens your lifetime, which is obviously very costly. But from conversations you've had with people or where folks are saying, ah, you know, I just don't have the margin for more time or for more money. Are there things you tend to see people overlook?
I see people buying a lot of wine. I see people buying a lot of wine, you know, and I'm not going to get into that because there's a lot of misogyny there, but, yeah. Again, I think it's one of those stress habits. You know, when you follow me, maybe I should shut up.
No, time out. No, Rich, I think knows why I'm like dying over here, because there was one episode where I talked about, okay, I've moved now, so I could talk about this anonymously. I had a neighbor, and I never saw this person for months, but every roughly week there would be like those little cartons of milk, except it was six empty wine bottles. And I'm like, man, this must be like a frat house or something. They must be tearing it down in there. It's a party. It didn't make any noise or anything like that. And so I didn't think anything of it. There was always a cat like that they would let out. And I'm like, man, they're really partying over here. I need to get like this. And then one day I walked by and it was like this little bitty 5'1" lady, maybe in her 60s or something. And I'm like, God, she's putting away six wine bottles a week. Now, hey, judgment-free zone, don't get me wrong, but I was just the disconnect, like, of what I expected was happening in that. Now, mind you, it might have still been a party zone. Don't get me wrong. Not saying 60-year-olds can't party. But what I thought was taking place in that apartment was not, I think, taking place in that apartment, juxtaposed by the bottles of wine that I saw on the outside. And maybe she poured them down the sink. Maybe she was in a wine club. I don't know the whole full story. So to get myself out of trouble, which I think you were trying to avoid here, how did you calculate the retirement number? So you said you looked out there in the window, you know, the sun's glaring in your eyes, you're squinting and you can see your friends on the kayak on the lake outside. You know, they're probably waving to you like, sucker, you know, selling out to the man. You went back to your desk, and how did you crunch the numbers?
Well, I want to put that in context. I mean, this was in the early 90s. I didn't really have access to the internet because it was in such a state of infancy. I had to kind of make my own assumptions and do my own number crunching. And so I did, and I took essentially a monthly savings number and plugged it into my spreadsheet, drew a stock market return number out of thin air, 10% at the time, I think I was assuming. And I never built in any kind of fuzzy math. So I was assuming that 10% was the number, and I would always make 10% a year. And I took my take home pay at the time, which was about 30 grand. And I like my lifestyle. And so I said, okay, how much do I need to kick out 30 grand at 10%? I need $300,000. Like, okay, that's the number. I was single. My living expenses were really cheap. I was splitting a house with my brother and stuff like that. So it was, I think, a good place to start. But as I worked on it more, and as I became a little more financially sophisticated than MBA school had made me, and I need to come back to that, you know, I learned, no, it's more complex than that situation. I need to start building in more variables. I need to make my assumptions more realistic. And so the numbers started going up, and my lifestyle cost was increasing. I got married and, you know, moved to a bigger city and stuff. So the number kept changing. The goalpost kept moving back. And that just motivated me to chase after those goalposts all the harder. I had to outrun them, you know.
And so did you move to a bigger city just because that was something that you and your wife wanted to do? Or was that specifically part of your plan to get ahead financially so you could, you know, maybe jump into that lifestyle down the road?
I was working in the public sector and had this great opportunity to jump over into the private sector to make more money. I mean, a lot more money. I got a really nice bump out of that. And I had the geographic arbitrage. I mean, we were making more. We held our lifestyle more or less at the same level. So I was able to bank more. That paid off a lot. I also had more investment opportunities. We started running real estate, stuff like that. I was deliberately trying to make more money, but there was also the opportunity to have a lot more fun too. Mm. It was a bigger city, more opportunities to do stuff. So yeah, so there was that. It was more complicated than just one motivating factor. There were several, hey, we're young, let's go explore the world, you know, stuff like that. There were several different factors.
Got it.
So I actually really like that. And I honestly, I don't know. So to me, 300,000 sounds reasonable and doable. I don't know. Some people faint it and they moved on to the next show. But I really like that number sounds doable and we kick out 30,000 a year at a $300,000 savings. And then it just goes up from there. Because I think what it also helps is most people have no idea what their retirement number is or even couldn't be. So for me, that actually gives me security. Like, okay, here's what I'm driving towards. I hear some people say, it's honestly frustrating to me, but I see why they say it. They're like, well, all you're telling me is a number. And although right now is the date of this podcast, there's very few autonomous driving cars. I'm like, you know, Siri doesn't drive the car for you. She tells you how to get there. But no one complains like, well, all she did was give me a map. And I'm like, yeah, this is this is how you get to the journey you told me was your destination. Do you have thoughts on how to overcome that, or how did you adjust that 300,000 and up for those new lifestyle changes?
The first thing I had to do, I mean, again, in the absence of having these rich data sources that you can find on the web these days, the first thing I had to do was get my spreadsheet skills up to speed.
I'm waving my fist at that because I hate spreadsheets.
You absolutely have to do your own thinking when it comes to this kind of thing. You cannot use somebody else's numbers. You cannot solely rely on other people's numbers. You can't solely rely on the 7.5% S&P projection. You know, the models that online calculators like FireCalc produce, all those are suggestions. Ultimately, you're the only one who knows what your life is. And so you have to model your life. And you have to try to do a pretty good job modeling the contingencies that would come up. And you can only do that by running a whole bunch of different models in different degrees of complexity. And you can only do that if you know how to run a spreadsheet. I mean, it all comes back to that. The next thing you need to do is find good data sources. And that's not so hard these days. You do have to know what data to look for, but it's easier to find out how to craft these plans.
This episode is sponsored by HealthIQ. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, HealthIQ saves money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. That means you're staying fit, eating right, and doing those things that are supposed to make you live a long time. Even if you have one of the many pre-existing conditions, HealthIQ can help you keep more cash in your wallet. Now tell me, how's that a bad thing? Ow, ow. To see if you qualify for the most exclusive rates, which can be up to 33% savings, that's guap. Get your free quote today at healthiq.com/paychecks. Again, that's healthiq.com/paychecks. And now back to the show.
The first time I heard of you guys, I was out running and I was in Fort Walton Beach, found your show through your Twitter feed, and I was listening to your show on the 4% rule. Do you remember that? Do you remember that podcast? That
episode? Yeah, I'm probably going to plug it. There's a few, but we had the college investor on, and he had did a fire article as well about the 4% rule. And basically, for folks who are new, the 4% rule was a calculation. Don't ask me from the, it was a CFP or a CPA. It's like from the 1950s. The study was from like 1950 to like 1995. But if you withdraw 4% from whatever your retirement number is, no matter if the market went up and down, it would last, I think he said something along the lines of like 99 years. So basically, on that time period, now we are in some interesting times, but that's a very significant time period in which there was no scenario where you would deplete it in retirement, was essentially what it proved. Now, there's been some debate. You can do it at 3% or should you, you know, allocate it up to 4-5% and everything like that. But it is a proven and largely wide respected philosophy for a drawdown rate.
Man, I am so sorry, but I have to disagree. I've got to disagree with that.
I think that's good.
The 4% rule is rooted in some pretty sound analysis and sound history. You hear all the time that past performance is no guarantee of future success. The circumstances under which the 4% rule, the original safe max, as discussed by William Bengen and the Trinity study, too, the assumptions were so much different than the times we live in right now, that to say the 4% rule holds true now is pretty dangerous. There's also something called sequence of returns risk. Are you familiar?
I'm not familiar with that term.
Neither am I.
So you've got the 300,000 and you want to withdraw a 4%, right? If you withdraw that the first year, that 12 grand the first year, you know, and if the market goes down two, what do you do the next year? Okay, now you're trying to get the same 12 grand out of less money. You know, if you get a 15% drop, well, where is that 12 grand supposed to come from now? And if you get another 15% drop, where does it come from now? What you're expecting the market to do is to return higher and higher and higher amounts, but it's not. It's returning lower and lower. And so in order to cope with that, what you have to do is decrease your withdrawal amount if you want to maintain that 4%. What that means is that your ability to budget for your expenses is just all over the map. It becomes, you know, you can spend a lot one year, you have to spend zero the next year, and nobody can plan their life around that. So if you rely on that rule as hard and fast, and you're unlucky and you come into a bad market when you retire, you can bankrupt yourself if you're not careful. You can really get yourself into a bad financial situation.
Along those lines, do you think that could be overcome? Is that the time or near that time? And I'm going to say near pretty liberally. So I'll say 5, maybe even 10 years out from retirement, if you've been striving towards this number, to partner with a financial planner or a investment broker? Or when do you think that those more advanced discussions, if at all, should be taking place?
I think that people will be surprised at how simple it is really to acquire this knowledge for themselves without paying a financial advisor.
Okay.
Your average person has kind of a simple financial structure. Okay. And so they don't need a bunch of complicated advice about how to manage that. So I would encourage people just to study this material on their own for a while and acquire a level of competency that allows them, you know, or that gives them some confidence that they know how to manage their own financial situation pretty well. And that's what will give them the perspective on whether they should go to a financial advisor or not. Self-education in this area is a lot less difficult than a lot of people think.
In the article, which I'll get in the show notes, the History of Financial Independence and Early Retirement Movement, you recommended the Intelligent Investor. Do you still think that's a good place for a novice to start? Is that more of an advanced read, or what would you recommend for that self-education?
I would certainly recommend that, but I think it's more of an advanced read. That book is more about how to pick stocks, pick individual stocks. I don't think a beginning investor needs to do that. There are, you know, Vanguard's S&P index fund has a very good track record, has a very good return record that it gets simply from tracking the S&P 500 index. That's so easy to get into. It's so easy to step back from. The fees are so low that it's the go-to for, I don't know, I can't quote you an exact percentage, but it seems to be the go-to investment for everybody in the financial independence community. So that's kind of where I would begin, is looking at things like that. I don't think you should start out with like hardcore mathematical analysis of individual stock picking at all. You'll wind up learning why stock picking isn't necessary when you start reading the beginning stuff.
Yeah, I get that. From the article as well, and I really want to hit this point because I think it's going to apply to a lot of our listeners, and I think it'll definitely apply in the future. In the early 1990s, employers came to favor 401ks in large part because doing so enhanced their bottom lines by enabling them to cost shift retirement plans to employees, deliberately killing the company pension in the process. I feel, correct me if I'm wrong or if you feel differently, I don't think people recognize the gravity of that switch. And then this current and future generations, I think now it's unanimous almost. I think it's like 90% of people either have a 401k or nothing available to them. But I don't think folks realize the burden of that shift. And now we're seeing the implications because people are like, oh, I don't have enough for retirement. And it's like, well, whom else do you think is going to fund it for you? And I still think people are struggling to wrap their heads around that. Am I overemphasizing that shift, or do you feel the same way or differently?
I totally feel the same way. You told me that your listeners tend to be millennials. I'm preaching to the choir here, but compound interest says that when you are youngest is the best time to fund your 401k if you're going to self-fund. Well, who has money at 25 to max out their 401k when they're trying to pay off 100 grand worth of student loans? Okay. You can't do it. So the deck is so stacked that, you know, you can start seeing that if you had a defined benefit retirement program, that would be preferable to not being able to fund a retirement at all. So,
and from NerdWallet, they, and I think this is what you were speaking to about the 4% rule, they were saying that millennials at that time, and this article is a few years old now, would have to invest 22% of their gross pre-tax just to get the returns that generations before them were seeing, because the markets are looking like we might expect 5% return on average. What, if any, changes can these young people make to overcome for those possibly, if not actually, lower average returns? Is it just pour more money in, or is there some other scenario?
There's two ways. You can save more, and I recommend that to people. Cut your expenses, increase your increase your knowledge and you know, see what you can do about putting more money into your retirement accounts. People also, I think, tend to focus too much on the idea that I need a really big number so I can maintain my current lifestyle when I retire. I don't know. Are you guys familiar with the concept of lean FIRE?
Yes.
I remember hearing lean FIRE and fat FIRE, but I'm not going to act like I remember the full definitions of both.
Okay. Well, most people focus on fat FIRE, which is where you try to have a capital pool that's big enough to kick out the 4% and all that. And you're trying to retire with absolute security. Well, it's also possible to get out of the workforce, that, you know, the traditional like corporate American workforce, like we're talking about, and move into a lifestyle where your expenses are so low that you can meet them working a part-time job or something like that, that you enjoy a whole lot more. There are examples. This is going to be a pretty common example, but you'll find people who leave the workforce and go out and start community farms, small farms, and grow organic farm-to-table type food that they sell to local restaurants. You see a good bit of that. These folks, they're working harder. They're earning less money. But the ones I've talked to say, hey, I wouldn't have it any other way. I love this lifestyle. I no longer feel miserable in a job I'm not suited for. Yes, it's riskier. But is it riskier compared to the thought of 40 or 50 years sitting at a desk, you know, miserable in a job? You know, maybe not. And so I encourage people who are in the situation we're talking about to do check out, you know, Lean FIRE and see whether they think it might be for them.
And I think along those same lines, someone asked me this question and I almost felt bad that I could not give the answer that they wanted. And they blatantly asked me, I think I can keep this anonymous, but I was in New York and they were, you know, they had listened to a program that I was on and they were like, well, how do I account for cost of living in a city like New York? And I would say, you know, similarly for folks who want to live and die in LA, shout out to R.I.P. Tupac, you know, I honestly don't know because I didn't even realize it. I'm talking about, you know, 28 years of my life in Texas, 7 years in Denver, and Denver's pretty expensive, but Colorado as a state is pretty low cost of living. Same thing with Texas. I didn't realize the benefit that that was having on my savings. Someone told me, and I think there was a study to support it, that in cities like New York, 80% of income is going to home, just having a roof over your head. And I could not even wrap my head around that reality. So when 80% of your income, or at least your expenses, I should say, is home, how do you then cut back or find this minimalist lifestyle? And I was trying to deal with that, but to date, I still don't readily have an answer. So that's what I'm ultimately building up to, if either one of you have one. But mine was, so if I was in Texas, similar to what you're saying, do you make the sacrifice for the greater good of, well, do I need to retire in this city? Because my answer here is, well, there's so many surrounding cities and suburbs. If it meant 50 less years in this workforce, in this cubicle or in this offical or whatever thing I'm going to be occupying at the time, I'm going to move to the smaller city. And guess what? I'll visit Austin or I'll visit New York if it afforded me that ability. Do you have another scenario for folks who are like, yo, I'm going to, in this case, live and die in New York?
You have to pick your priorities. I mean, if New York is a city for you and you must live there, and the way to finance your lifestyle is to have a corporate job, then that's what you've chosen. There's your choice. And I won't cast any aspersion on that. I think that's a perfectly valid lifestyle. But if your goals are contradictory, I want to retire early, but I can't afford to save money and I want to live in New York. It's like, well, you need to resolve that. And I'm not sure how you do that. It's going to take a good bit of introspection in order for you to resolve that. But yeah, there are contradictory goals out there, certainly. I'll say this in terms of, you know, what you were talking about with Denver and Texas and LA and, you know, in New York. When we left, and I'll say it was Boston. Ooh. We were living in Boston and we were running real estate up there. Yeah, right. It's expensive. It's not as expensive as other cities, but
5 years there, I remember.
Oh, no, we should chat sometimes. Fun town. But the appreciation on the home that we owned, simply the appreciation, not the principal that we were holding, paid for the entirety, it paid in entirety for the house that we bought in the rural location.
Wow.
We basically got a free house.
So you're the people from HGTV. And I'm always like, where do they get all this money? You're the people. You're those people. All right. Yeah. Mystery solved. Richard, sound like you had a comment.
Well, I'm just thinking because I had the conversation yesterday with a family member where, you know, they're asking, so where do you plan to be in 3 or 4 years? And I'm like, not in the Bay Area. When are you going to buy a house? I am not buying a house here. And I started thinking about where I want to go next. And, you know, it's no secret that I want to get to a point where I have the choice to walk away from the day gig. And I've thought about it. And I'm like, you know, if I did actually walk away, I would walk myself. I was going to say something else right out of this part of California, just because it's so expensive to live. And I was thinking about how much money I need to live out here on a month-to-month basis versus what I would need to live in a different city. And so when I think about the number that I need to live out here, it's a very scary number. But if I take that very scary number and move to a city where the cost of living is much more reasonable, then that amount of money is going to last me that much longer. It could last me 2 times as long. So I'm even in the process right now of just rethinking what is that actual dollar amount for the cities that I may want to move to. And I think in general, people sometimes struggle with thinking ahead and having that forward-looking view. It's very easy to see what's in the next 3 to 6 months or what's in the next 12 months, but to really think 5 and 10 years down the road and what you want your lifestyle to be like the dude said, that does require a lot of introspection. And there are things that may change over time. You know, when you're single, you may think one way. When you have a partner and your partner has whatever life goals, hashtag, and dreams, you may start thinking a different way. And so I feel like for myself, I've had to recalibrate a little bit there. So there wasn't really a question in that, but I was feeling quite introspective as I just sat here and listened. So anything you would add to that, the dude?
No, I mean, I think you've got your head screwed on perfectly straight there, especially with respect to the idea of planning. I mean, we don't do, you know, in American culture, you know, in my opinion, we don't do a very good job of planning out more than a year or two. There's that strong vision thing. I mean, there's, you know, there are cultures in this world where they're thinking 50 years ahead. If I'm not mistaken, you get to Japan, you get in the major cities of Japan, and there are 100-year mortgages.
What?
I've heard. Yeah. Oh, wow. Oh, hang on. I'm going to Google that up real quick because I want to make sure I'm not talking out of my butt. But
yeah, I've heard of the subways where they literally push people into the cars and pack them like sardines, but I have not heard of this. I guess those are two completely different things, but that's like the one thing I heard.
I think
it does exist. 100-year mortgages. Yeah, 100-year mortgages. So,
but
documented.
I'm going to have to get that in the show notes for sure, because someone's going to ask. But another thing, I mean, around this discussion, I think most folks, and here's another thing that I don't know if it's privilege or a unique experience or the combination of both, but most folks can't wrap their head around. I jokingly said live and die in LA, but there's some people listening, like they're like, yeah, like there is no other scenario. And I'm like, I move all the time. I've moved 7 times within my own state. And so I also have to recognize that you don't have to commit to it forever. I mean, unless you sign a 100-year loan. But you move, and then like Diddy said, you know, when you don't like it, change it, and then change it again. Like, if you go there and it doesn't work out, and I'd say, because there's going to be somebody who writes in and had some horrible experience, but 90% of scenarios, it's like a road trip as going back to the series. You U-turn. You like, oh, I went, didn't work out. When I moved to Denver, I was on a, and I thought this, again, you extrapolate that your experience is everyone's experience. So Rich had to correct me that this isn't everyone's experience, but I moved to a place with a 6-month probation. And so essentially for 6 months, they could release me without calls at any time. And I just moved on the chance and hope and belief in myself that it would work out. And ultimately it did. I was there for 7 years. But if I had let fear or indecision or, oh man, 6 month probation, like there was no negotiating, like it either is going to work or it is going to fail. And my parents were really impressed and fascinated by that. But in the back of my mind, I was like, I'll just move home. They never knew my backup plan B was just, I'll just go back home. But in my head, that was always the backup plan. So, you know, you have the plan A, but I think that's where most people start, is plan A. And then you actually gain security by having plan B through Z. And I think these scenarios that we're talking about is how you plan for those.
Definitely. Definitely. So we're rounding toward the end of the show here. And dude, I did have one more question for you, just so we can bring it home for the audience and give them something actionable to walk away with. And some of this we've talked about already, but just to tie it together. So I guess what are probably the top two or three actionable things that people should do now to begin preparing for the FIRE lifestyle or figuring out if that makes sense for them? And so you mentioned self-education as something that's really important. I also know that that's something that you've written about. But for someone who's just really at the beginning, just trying to get their stuff together, what are the things, the key things they can start doing now that'll feel like little victories or put them on the path that they need to be on?
Regardless of whether or not you plan to or ever actually achieve, you know, financial independence and early retirement, it can never hurt you to make your financial structure, your personal financial structure, more sound. So if I had to give people one piece of advice, it would be get on that traditional track of, you know, paying down your higher interest debt, move from highest interest to lower interest, and get that high dollar debt taken care of. Get out of that situation, get back to zero and start to move in a positive direction. If you don't know when credit card debt can be good and when it's bad, learn. If you, you know, all of those little things add up, and you might think, well, this is just a really small amount of money. Why should I waste my time learning how to optimize it? Well, you should, because those things add up. So yeah, I mean, self-education is going to be number one. Number two will be learning how to live more frugally, starting to dial down your lifestyle. One way to do that is to take a look at your pastimes and try to get the most bang for the buck out of them. You might think a $100 pair of running shoes is going to be too much to spend, but look how many hours of running you're going to get out of a pair of those. You can run, you know, 350 miles or something like that. So amortize that. You're really spending, you know, who knows, a dime a mile, 50 cents an hour or something like that. I tell people the same thing about video game consoles. You might think it's an expensive pastime, but my daughter and I have been playing Lego Marvel Super Heroes for probably, I don't know, 100 hours together or something like that. It was a $12 game. You know, so look at things like that, because those are excellent ways to lower your lifestyle. Yeah, those are a couple of things I would start with now.
Awesome.
Little wins, little victories.
I'd also say a piece of it, because I'm cautious, not because you're wrong, but because of the psychology of people, is most people, they're like, well, live frugally. They think of that as giving up, not think of all the things they gain. And, you know, there's been several studies around this, but if you ask somebody, can you save 20%, they'll say no. But if you ask them if they can live on 80%, they say yes. And this is why doctors say you have a 20% chance of survival, because an 80% chance of death sounds daunting. But it's just a switch in how you approach it. So you're not giving up this money by living frugally. You're gaining, like you said, that investment back in yourself. You're living on 90%. And with that sacrifice of just 10%, and then it'll be beneficial to you in this scenario in the rest of your life, for your family, for your friends, or whatever those, what I call, or I've been saying lately, those 3 to 5 whys. Like, why are you on this journey? Because that's what's going to solidify you and bring you back and make sure you stay on the path, because ultimately you will fall off. Someone asked me, what if the plan doesn't work? And I go, well, I can ease that concern right now, because the plan will fail. And so don't worry about that. The plan will fail. The plan will go awry. The market will go down. You know, you'll get off schedule. You'll go to Sunday fun day or whatever the case may be. But you just get back on. And that's there. Most people, like the New Year's resolution, most people are done with their New Year's resolution by now. By the time this show drops, most people they forgot they made the New Year's resolution. Me saying the sentence is going to remind them. So the key is to make sure you know why and get back on that journey.
Definitely.
As far as that self-education goes, as we wrap up here, the dude, where can people find you around the social medias to continue their journey of self-learning?
Oh, sure. My blog is earlyretirementdude.com. Pretty straightforward. On Twitter, I'm at retireearlydude, something like that. Somebody took my name. retireearlydude. I'm also active on the Reddit Financial Independence sub, you know, reddit.com/r/financial independence. Very good community for finding out information. So those are the three places where I mostly hang out.
Cool. All right. The dude, thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the invitation.
As promised, we appreciate the dude joining us. I think you now know at least the steps that you can take to retire early, maybe as early as 36.
Yeah, man. I'm still working on that retirement age thing. I know it's not going to be 60, not even 55. I want it to be sooner than that. I should probably figure that out soon, shouldn't I?
You should. And we're actually going to talk about that on an upcoming episode in more detail. But I think for me, I don't know that my framework or my mindset for retiring and what that looks like, I think has changed. But I definitely, and we talk about it all the time, I can't see myself doing whatever this entails within the block of 40 hours for another, 35 years. It looks like I just need to be doing something differently. I just don't see retirement as me like laid out on the porcelain tubs, as I shout out to CBS Now, on the beach, like they do in the Super Bowl commercial that they recommend. But I don't know what it looks like. I just know it does not look like this.
Yeah, man. I want to be one of those wealthy people who has someone manage money that's given away for charitable things. Like, that's someone's full job. It's just to manage money that I'm giving away. That's how much guap I want to have in my account or in my life.
Hashtag like life goals.
Also, don't forget to join our email list by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email, where you'll receive our weekly newsletter covering actionable work and money tips and much more. And if you enjoyed today's episode or found it useful, be sure to share it with your network and hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts. So we have this review here today that I think we need to get through.
These guys, .. Jules. First, Pink Lady, 33-year-old mom and budding entrepreneur. I've been a faithful listener for close to 2 years now. I appreciate that. And I'm also happy I found Paychecks and Balances. What a clever name for the show. Shout out to Rich there. And while I listen to a number of podcasts aimed at young women of color, such as myself, Rich and Marcus are delightful. Their pairing makes for a nice set of male voices that round out my podcast lineup. Look forward to tuning in each week to soak up their insightful and valuable nuggets rooted in their own professional and personal experience. Both very knowledgeable in their respectful fields, HR and auditing. Shout out. I guess people are, that's hitting home now. Yeah, exactly. Each of them can always get at least one chuckle out of me each episode. Being able to apply a number of sound suggestions from them, I'm a happy listener. Always praying for Marcus that he continues to stay on the path of responsible money management. I appreciate that because it is difficult.
It's so hard.
Yo, why is everybody? She says, that's okay. Spending money on, a shout out to Fergie there. I see you tapping into your inner Fergie. money on an unnecessary set of rims. Yo, I felt like the rims were very necessary. But that being said, proud of you, guy. Always eager to hear how Rich will open up each show. Opening lines are fun. No pressure. And these guys, thanks to you both for your continued insights.
Yeah, I remember when the pressure we had when we used to do rap verses. And this is like a minor version of that. It's literally a few words, and I'm like, no, that's not it. No, like scribbling, throwing pieces of paper away, throwing them in an imaginary trash can. But I'm glad at least one person out there appreciates that.
Yeah, I will say we got invited to be on a potential mixtape, so the dream is still not dead. I'm hoping up to maybe open up for Drake summer 19, summer 2020. Yeah, it's still out there. It's in the back of my mind. Buy me some new rims.
Bars. And if you don't know how to leave us a 5-star review, you can go to paychecksandbalances.com/review. All the steps are there. Though I think it might still say iTunes, even though it's supposed to say Apple Podcasts. And I think I was supposed to update that like months ago, but it didn't happen. That's my bad. I guess that's in the 7% of things that we have not gotten done. But again, thanks to everyone for listening. Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.